You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Evening, Richard.
Evening, Lionel. And we can hear Rob Hatch in the background. We're at the we're in the London Velodrome. You heard at the start there the presentation of the riders, in particular the presentation of the final team. Team number one here, the world champions, the world Madison champions, Mark Cavendish and Sir Bradley Wiggins, both riding together here. They're really the headline act. This is the second revived London 60. It was held last year, very popular last year, big crowds, without really any, you know, household names, I suppose. So we did well last year to get a full house, and obviously it's ramped up this year. And we're sitting here on the first night. We're in Track Centre. The racing is underway. It's first Madison, and Mark Cavendish and Bradley Wiggins have been quite aggressive already. Bradley Wiggins riding with a very strange set of handlebars.
He is indeed, yeah. Kind of avoiding the elephant in the room here, aren't we? The elephant in the velodrome is that Bradley Wiggins got a tremendous reception from the crowd after quite an awful month of headlines and stories in the media. This was always going to be quite an interesting evening to see how the British public responded to Bradley Wiggins, and the answer to that is that, judging by the cheers for the Wiggins-Cavendish team, it's, with the public at least here, it doesn't feel like his standing is damaged at all.
This is quite a small sample of the British public, though, isn't it? Albeit it's a full house.
It is. It's also a sample of the British public made up entirely of cycling fans who presumably love Bradley Wiggins. I'm not being flippant, but, you know, if you were organising the London 6 Day, I imagine the organisers have had perhaps not sleepless nights, but certainly woken up in the middle of the night with a bit of a start, wondering how things would go. Tickets obviously sold, went on sale a long time in advance, so probably not much of a worry on that score. But in terms of how this event would be received by the mainstream media, it's going to be interesting as the week unfolds to see how that plays out.
Absolutely. Well, listen, we're going to go from the very noisy velodrome to the hushed environment of, I don't know, Lionel's library or wherever he records the news roundup in a moment. We're going to hear, you mentioned the organiser of the 6 Day, the roar there incidentally will inevitably be because either Cavendish or Wiggins are on the attack. We're going to hear from the organiser of this 6 Day and the man behind a revived series of 6 Days throughout Europe this winter. There we are, that was a sprint. Cavendish was third there. That was the end of the race, actually. Sorry, it just shows you, you switch off for a moment or two and you lose track of what's going on. What happened?
Very noisy in here, Richard. I didn't hear any of that at all, and I was watching the racing. That's the first Madison of the 6 Day, won by the Dutch pair, Yuri Havik and Wim Strootinger. So they're off to a good start. Be interesting to see how the racing unfold this week. If I was a betting man, and if you could bet on 6 Day racing, I would have a fiver on Wiggins and Cavendish winning this.
Yeah, no, that's a good shout, Lionel. As I say, we're going to go to Lionel's news roundup in a moment. We're going to come back, we're going to hear from the organiser of London 6 Day. Part two, we're going to cross over to Berlin and hear from Daniel about the route of the 2017 Giro d'Italia, which was announced earlier today. He'll have lots of insight into the mountains in particular, I think, the many Dolomite stages that there will be in the Giro, as there always is, of course. Dolomite police will be on my case. Part three, we'll come back to the velodrome here and wrap things up on the first night of London 6 Day. So over to you and your library, Lionel.
Thanks, Richard. I've teleported from the London velodrome back to my office to give this edition of the news roundup. After the World Championships in Doha, the racing continued across the Persian Gulf with the Abu Dhabi Tour in the United Arab Emirates. Italian sprinter Giacomo Nizzolo, who was fifth in the World Road Race, won the opening stage, and Mark Cavendish won a couple of stages, including the nighttime circuit race in Abu Dhabi on the last day. But the overall honours went to Estonia's Tanel Kangert of Astana. He won the mountain stage ahead of Nicholas Roach to win overall by 21 seconds. Diego Ulissi was third, with Vincenzo Nibali and Alberto Contador in fourth and fifth. The Abu Dhabi Tour will be back sooner than you think, because the third edition of the race will be held in February. It's the fourth race on the UCI's expanded World Tour calendar, coming shortly after the Tour of Qatar. That race marked the end of Tinkoff and brought Oleg Tinkoff's association with professional cycling to a close, for now at least. The Russian businessman had been involved for more than a decade, first with a team called Tinkoff Restaurants, a team he actually rode for in 2006. They later became Tinkoff Credit Systems, and Oleg Tinkoff was involved with Katusha for a while before buying Bjarne Riis's Saxo Bank squad. Anyway, his team signed off by racing the Abu Dhabi Tour in a jersey based on the old Tinkoff Credit System design. And Oleg's often divisive presence will be absent next year, but for how long, I wonder? In other racing, Davide Villela of Cannondale Drapac won the Japan Cup ahead of Orica Bike Exchange's Christopher Yule Jensen. The Chrono des Nations time trial at Les Herbiers in western France was won by Sky's Vasil Kirienka for the second year in a row. The Belarusian beat Jonathan Castroviejo of Movistar. And as the road season winds down, so the cyclocross campaign cranks into gear. There have already been two rounds of the UCI World Cup so far, in Las Vegas and Iowa in the United States, but the series moved to Europe at the weekend, with round three taking place in Valkenburg in the Netherlands. And there were home wins in both the men's and women's races, with Mathieu van der Poel and Talita de Jong taking the honours. The first Irish professional continental squad, Team Aqua Blue Sport, has announced a raft of new signings. Four-time Irish road race champion Matt Bramier joins from Dimension Data. Lars-Petter Nordhaug and Andy Fenn of Team Sky are joining, as is the British champion Adam Blythe, who moves over from Tinkoff, who are folding. They've also picked up Larry Warbass and Lee Howard from I Am Cycling. And finally, if you're near Edinburgh at the start of December, on December the 1st to be exact, and you like the cycling podcast, you may be interested in a live event we're doing at the Signet Library in Parliament Square. Richard and I will be joined by our good friend François Thomazeau. He's the French journalist who made a number of memorable appearances on the podcast during the Tour de France. Anyway, we're there on Thursday, December the 1st. To buy tickets, check out our page on Facebook, or if you go to thecyclingpodcast.com/live-events, all the details will be on there too.
Thank you for that, Lionel. That was good to have your weekly news round up. We're back into the noisy velodrome now. The sprinters are on the track, going to do the first of their races. There's Rob Hatch in his little booth. Rob Hatch providing the sort of live commentary here in the velodrome all week. It's not just about Cavendish and Wiggins, the racing here, with the endurance riders having paused for a moment. We'll maybe try and get some interviews with some of the other guys. Cam Meyer, the Australian rider who retired mid-season, he was riding with Dimension Data and he stopped, and this is a sort of comeback here after a very brief retirement, if that's what it was. So it'd be good to find out what the story is there with him and what his future plans are. Before we go on, I should mention a competition that we ran last week to win two pairs of tickets for the Ruler Classic event in London. Lots of big names attending that. And we offered two pairs of tickets last week. If people could write in and tell us why they should win these tickets. Now, the first winner is Michael Robinson, who emailed us to say that he thinks he should win the tickets because the 5th of November, which is the day of the session that the tickets were up for, is my birthday. So that's Michael Robinson's birthday. So Michael, congratulations, you win two of the tickets. Our second winner, who wins the other pair, is Luke Coleman. Hi guys, I would like to win the tickets to the Ruler Classic because Daniel refused to have a selfie with me at the Tour de France this year, and it will go some way to make up for my deep, deep hurt. Well, I hope it does, Luke. I hope it does help to penalties to recover from that blow of being refused a photograph by Daniel at the Tour de France. Awful. Lionel shaking his head.
He's changed, hasn't he, since he's been on the telly box, you know. What can we say about Daniel, eh, and his newfound fame? He's going to have to get used to it, isn't he? He can't be a shrinking violet when the public come up to him and want a picture or an autograph, or they want to invite him on some kind of holiday with them. All that kind of thing, which happens to people on TV, doesn't it?
Apparently so. Come on, Daniel. Come on. If you're listening, Daniel. Anyway, we're back in the track here. Lionel Racing is going on. Unfortunately, Wiggins is not going to be doing any media this week, so we're not going to get a sit-down conversation with Bradley Wiggins at any point. It's been made clear to everybody here, and there's quite a few media here tonight, that Wiggins will not be doing any media. I guess that's both understandable and in keeping with his strategy ever since the TUE story has broke, with a couple of exceptions, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, when all this was planned out, this was his big London farewell, and then the final farewell at the Ghent Six, the city of his birth, of course. And it would be really interesting to know what's going on in his mind at the moment. He's currently in the track centre with his wife Kath and his children. And I imagine after the, you know, whatever you think of the Bradley Wiggins story, whether you're at one wing or the other in terms of whether you think he's done right or wrong, or whether this has all been blown out of proportion, at the end of the day, there's still a human being at the centre of this, and it would be really interesting to know what's going through his mind here. You know, he's racing very hard, the centre of attention, but it's not quite the final farewell that he perhaps hoped it would be.
And yet he's obviously, or apparently, been working hard for this. He is, the word on the street is, or the word on the boards is, that he's going very well. And Mark Cavendish is going very well, as we saw in Abu Dhabi last week. So he's finishing the season with a real flourish as well. We've been working for a few weeks now on a Bradley Wiggins special, Full Circle. That'll be our final Friends special of 2016. That'll come out in, I think, early December. Late November, early December. Working for a few weeks. We've been working on that before the TUE story. It'll be a pretty rounded look back at his career. It certainly won't be dominated by the recent controversy. We'll try and we've got some interviews with some very interesting people who've been worked very closely with Bradley Wiggins, who'll be in that, and we'll try and tell a quite a rounded story, but obviously we'll cover this element of the story as well, and look at how it will affect his legacy. So anything else? Well, let's hear actually from the organiser of the London 68, the man who has been involved in resurrecting this event, and then also in joining it with other 6 days throughout Europe. Amsterdam, Berlin and Copenhagen will all form part of the series, and it will finish the series in Mallorca in the Velodrome there, which I don't think has ever had a 6 day race before, and in fact it won't have a 6 day race this time because it's a 1 day race to finish off the series in Mallorca, but that will perhaps be build towards a multi-day race next year. So anyway, I spoke earlier on tonight to Mark Darbin, who's the chief executive of the Madison Sports Group, who are behind this event. Here is Mark Darbin. So Mark, you were the man behind the London 6 day last year, which was launched after several decades absent. I think the last from 1980, I think, in London at Wembley, the old Skull 6 day. Last year seemed to be a great success, but what was the thinking behind re-establishing a 6 day in London?
We like all of the aspects of a six-day race. We think you have the best riders in the world, a variety of disciplines, which keeps the racing interesting and competitive, but all set against a backdrop of entertainment. A lot of other sports are doing that, fusing sport with entertainment, and so we wanted to try and take it on and do the same with six-day.
And how did it go, the first one?
It was great. I mean, it's hard launching a new event. We struggled on the calendar last year, so we didn't have some of the biggest names here. But we had unbelievable feedback from the people that came to watch, from the media and from riders. And I think you find that this year is bigger and better.
Well, you've got obviously the two main draws, Mark Cavendish and Bradley Wiggins this year. I guess that's been very significant in terms of selling tickets.
Yeah, absolutely. It's fantastic having Brad and Cav here as world champions in the Madison. It's obviously an Olympic year, so there was a huge amount of GB success. We've got an unbelievably strong international field, multiple world and Olympic champions. So that, combined with the great feedback we had last year, I think was a recipe for success this time round.
So how many tickets have you sold? Are there still tickets available for some of the nights?
There are a handful of tickets available tonight. The remaining five nights are essentially sold out. I think we've got a couple left tomorrow, but very limited supplies. So the reception's been amazing. Over 30,000 people will witness some great racing this week.
And tell me about the expanded series. Six-day racing has maybe suffered in the last few years. You know, it used to be such a big thing in the winter, and it's interesting the comparison with other sports. You know, are we talking sort of 20-20 cricket, that kind of thing, on a bike in a velodrome? Tell me about the series that you're sort of launching this year.
Sure. Well, we fell in love with six-day racing because of its history. You know, invented in the 1870s, biggest spectator sport in the US in the 1920s, but it's nowhere really today. So for us, we were enthralled by the success of London. We bought an event in Berlin, a really long-running six-day. So we're taking London and Berlin. We're launching events in Amsterdam and Mallorca. And we're working with the organizers of the Copenhagen six-day to have the first ever series. So consistent branding, consistent format, riders qualify for the final, and at the end of the season, we'll have a winner.
There's also other things happening, of course. You know, Revolution's been established for years, the Champions League, in collaboration with Velon this winter as well. Are we witnessing perhaps a real resurgence of interest in racing on the track?
Yeah, look, we think it's a great thing that the sport is growing. I think we're all here to raise the sea level for track cycling. When we look at the events, we see an opportunity to make them more interesting, easier for fans to follow, and to fuse great racing with great entertainment. And I think our proposition stands out on that front.
In terms of the other events, I mean, you've obviously got Wiggins and Cavendish here. Will it be a target to have sort of big names from the road competing in some of those events?
Yeah, we've got an unbelievably strong field. So I think across our series, we've got 98 former world champions or former world titles between the riders. Incredibly strong across male and female. We get a number of the road riders who want to compete at our events. We're in the winter season. It helps them stay fit. You know, that's a big part of the history of six-day racing. But we also want to grow our own stars and stars for the future. So we're really excited to have some young British riders here who we think are going to do really well in the season.
You're listening to The Cycling Podcast in association with RAFA, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
So that was Mark Darbin, the group behind the London Six Day, and you know, is trying really hard to obviously resurrect interest in six-day racing throughout Europe. And I think that is something that you certainly would welcome, Lionel, as a man behind one of our famous or infamous old podcasts from the Ghent Six, which, well, infamous because it featured a cat. The Ghent Cat.
The Ghent Cat, yeah, that was a couple of years ago when I was at the Ghent Six, and somehow a domestic cat got onto the track and nearly got squashed under the wheels. The riders did well to avoid him. And then he ran up into the seats and somebody grabbed the cat by the scruff of the neck and held him up, and it was I was just relieved the cat survived, really. I mean, it could have been a very unpleasant end.
You actually interviewed the cat for the podcast.
I don't want to break any secrets here, but that was actually my own cat. Sorry, that was podcast doping. I recorded my own cat meowing for food and pretended it was an exclusive interview. It's really hard to fake interviews for a podcast unless you're really good at accents. But on a serious note, I think back to a year ago, Rich, and coming in to the velodrome here in London for the first day of the reborn London Six, and being perhaps a little bit critical of... There was quite a cold atmosphere, I felt, that day. Maybe that was me. Certainly today, it feels like the event has kind of blossomed, it's grown, there's perhaps a bit more confidence about it. And I certainly think that the unveiling of this series of events, Berlin is on the agenda, Copenhagen, and then the single-day final at Palma, Mallorca, gives a sort of coherence and structure to a season of track racing, which... in years to come, you know, could attract many more road riders to race on the track over the winter, which at the end of the day, that is the heyday of track racing in the 60s, 70s and 80s, was really founded on the fact that Eddie Merckx would ride 6 days, and a lot of the riders from the road, roadman sprinter types would come and do the 6 day races. And when the road riders kind of moved away, that was when the whole scene began to collapse. The thing that track racing has got and these events have got is that you've got people all paying to get in. And that's one of the biggest problems that road cycling has as it tries to grow as a sport and as the key stakeholders try to monetize. People can stand on the roadside free, and I'm certainly not advocating charging people to stand on the roadside, but series like this can certainly lead the way in terms of commercialising. And I think one of the really interesting trends this winter, and something I'll be keeping an eye on, is how the Revolution Series and the new Champions League of cycling, which includes quite a lot of the pro teams and the top road riders, that's a really interesting development. And having these two competing series, or two series, perhaps they're not competing, but they're certainly running side by side, gives cycling fans something to watch all over the winter. And I think TV coverage is a lot easier when you've got just one location in one velodrome. This is live on Eurosport this week. So there's a real momentum behind the track events, and I think the road side of the sport is going in the wrong direction in terms of ballooning the calendar. The World Tour is up to 37 events next year, I think. And track racing has got a lot to show the way, I think, here.
In terms of, yeah, coherence, I guess one of the key things here, obviously, is money. And in the old days, the 6 days were pretty lucrative, and road riders would actually earn quite a lot of money. Quite a lot of their income would come from the track in the 6 days. They started drifting away from the track in the winter when salaries on the road began to increase, as they did in the late 80s, you know, with Greg LeMond obviously leading the way. Greg LeMond rode a few 6 days in the late 80s, but really through the 90s and the 2000s, the top road riders have stayed away from the track. Mark Cavendish, Bradley Wiggins are exceptions. They've ridden a few Ghent sixes and other races.
Yeah, I mean, anyone who remembers the 80s would remember Stephen Roach, the Irish rider who rode the Paris 6 day for a lot of money and crashed, damaged his knee, which really, you know, ruled him out for sort of 18 months. And I'm not saying that you're going to see Chris Froome and Nairo Quintana riding 6 days, but certainly the sort of roadman sprinter type, Mark Cavendish, a lot of the other sprinters, you know, the sort of breakaway type riders, there's a lot to offer them here on track events like this. Having said that, you wouldn't then want to also do the pure 6 day riders out of a living as well. I mean, you know, the skill of Kenny de Ketelaere and Moreno de Pau, you know, they're leading Madison riders. They won this event last year. They're one of the star draws at the Ghent Six.
Absolutely. There's no reason why a Marcel Kittel or André Greipel, these guys, this, you know, the other thing is, traditionally, riders would lay their base miles, their foundation over the winter, and the high intensity stuff would come later on. And the thinking's changed a little bit on that. It's totally different, but a few weeks ago I went to an event with ultra endurance riders, and one girl who was there who was training for an ultra endurance event in the summer, works full time, was saying she does all her high intensity work through the winter and does her endurance stuff in the summer. Totally different, obviously not the same type of competition, but certainly a lot of the road riders now are doing more intensity in the winter, and 6 day racing would fit perfectly with that.
Yeah, and I think the skill of the riders, I'm not saying they weren't skillful back in the day, but you know, the risks are not so great that you know, Mark Cavendish is here, he's riding Ghent, you know, there's no concern from the trade team that he's going to rule himself out for the whole season with a crash. I mean, you know, that element is reduced, I think. But yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing how all of this track racing fits together. And I think there's some lessons there for the road calendar to pick up from. More events that dovetail together and kind of lead to some sort of conclusion.
Fernando Gaviria as well is another, you know, roadman sprinter who's a very skillful track rider. And I guess the other aspect, as well as the physiological aspect, the fitness side of things, is the skill aspect. You know, the track is a fantastic place. We were talking a couple of weeks ago before the World Championships in Qatar about how Marcel Kittel can be sort of bullied out of things in the crosswinds. And some of these guys, as fast and as strong as they are, do struggle more with the technical aspects where, you know, Gaviria certainly doesn't, Mark Cavendish certainly doesn't. So maybe there's something to be learned there from track racing. Oh, here's Rob Hatch. Maybe ask Rob how he's getting on in a moment, but just want to mention again the Bradley Wiggins story that we've been covering. Obviously, we've had a lot of correspondence on this, a lot of very interesting, very thoughtful emails. We had one that asked a question that we feel we should clear up, and Lionel's going to clear this one up. This is from Theodore Folders, professor of philosophy, no less, at Santa Barbara City College in the US. He sent us his thoughts on our recent Dave Brailsford episode. He quotes Aristotle in it, which is nice. But at the end, he finishes with a question. Oh, and what the heck is a jiffy bag, he asks. Brits sure do have a funny way of talking.
Well, Theodore, a jiffy bag is a padded envelope for sending something that you don't want to get damaged through the post, or for taking medical supplies from the UK to Switzerland and then on to France.
Allegedly.
Well, I don't think there's any allegations. There's no allegedly about that. That did happen. We just don't know what was in the jiffy bag. But in brief, a jiffy bag is a big padded envelope.
Eurosport, the home of cycling.
Thank you very much to Eurosport for sponsoring the cycling podcast. Very grateful indeed to them. Still plenty of cycling on Eurosport, including the London 60, which is ongoing, obviously, and will run till Sunday. Now, Lionel, you are going to speak to Daniel about the Giro route announced today, and you've got that up on your phone there. It's covering a lot of Italy and the islands.
It is indeed. It's the 100th edition, Rich, of the Giro d'Italia. First run in 1909, but because of the World Wars, this is now the 100th edition coming up in 2017, and they're trying to cover as much of Italy as possible, starting off, of course, in Sardinia, then going across to Sicily, and then working their way up from the boot of Italy all the way up to kind of the middle of the thigh of Italy, I guess. Is that how it works? We always refer to the boot of Italy, don't we? And then we never refer to the rest of the leg.
I think it's going to the top of the boot, which is just below the knee, usually.
It's going to the top of the boot. Oh, yeah, of course. Sorry, yeah. There's no knee, is there? The knee is like Austria or Switzerland, maybe. But
or France.
The Giro route is caressing the calf of Italy. And then that knotty bit at the back of the knee. A lot of mountain stages up there in the north. Daniel,
it's tickling the Achilles.
It's tickling the Achilles, yeah. But really, I mean, I don't want to speak out of turn. We need to get the authority on the Dolomites before I commit to how many of the 21 stages are in the Dolomites. I think 18 or 19 of the stages are in the Dolomites this year. But look, snap, look at the route, Rich. And unless we can get a lot of people signing up as friends of the podcast, unfortunately, funding issues mean we can't all go for all of it, can we? We have to do this Madison style switchover where I hand sling you in, or vice versa. So assuming that we don't get loads and loads of people signing up as friends of the podcast for 2017, which obviously I hope does happen, so we can all be there for all of it, but theoretically, say you had to do a couple of weeks, which couple of weeks would you most like to do?
You already showed me a map of Italy and said, what bit do you fancy? I said, do I have to choose now? Am I committing myself here? But I must say that this year I love the south of Italy. For all Daniel's lectures about how Italy, cycling in the south of Italy is just barely registers, there was a real passion for the Giro, for having a big event in the south of Italy, I felt. I loved it. I loved the south of Italy. And so I'd be more than willing to go back there. I've been to Sicily before, never been to Sardinia, but I know Sicily pretty well. I think I'd be more than happy to, you know, run across the toes of Italy, across to the Achilles, and then up the lower calf.
Are you even happy to take on what I gather is a 12 or 14 hour ferry crossing from Sardinia to Sicily? I mean, I'm not great at sea.
Yeah, I think we might get the Rafa helicopter for that line. We play our cards right. We'll find some way of managing that journey. It is quite a journey, isn't it? I'm not sure how that's going to be done, but we'll find a way. Where there's a will, there's a way.
Well, there's also a summit finish at Etna, which I believe is due to erupt at some point. I mean, the nature of volcanoes is that they will erupt at some point. people say it's due an eruption. I mean, I'd hate that to happen while you're there, but I think I'm happy. I think I'm happy for you to take that stage. I'd like to drop in at Florence. Lovely city there in the heart of Tuscany. I think I'll parachute in for the glamorous bit in Tuscany and Umbria.
Bit of a cliche that, isn't it, Lionel? You parachuting in Florence. But yeah, fine. I mean, hey, listen, we've got lots of time to work this one out. And if we have all these, you know, friends of the podcast, I will maybe be all three of us there for the ideal scenario is all three of us for all three Grand Tours, isn't it? That's the dream scenario. That's the dream. But anyway, before we, you know, carry on with our uneducated nonsense about the Giro, we should pass to Daniel. But you've got something else to say.
Yeah, I'm going to get Daniel on the phone. The pressing issue, of course, is, well, the two pressing issues are, where are the Dolomite stages and what am I going to be eating? That's the most important thing about the entire Giro.
Hello, Daniel.
How are you? Where are you?
Hello there. I'm in my office. The reason I thought I'd give you a call, Daniel, is because the Giro d'Italia route has been unveiled for 2017. And having enjoyed very much my couple of weeks at the Giro this year, I was looking at it in interest and realising that I don't know an awful lot about many of the places that it's going. So what immediately caught your eye when they confirmed the full route?
Well, it's obviously a special Giro, 100th Giro, so they wanted to visit as much of Italy as possible. Some drawbacks to that. One thing I did notice was that the transfers, the distance between stage finishes and starts, looked to be quite long. There was a bit of a backlash against that trend that we had seen in the Giro for a number of years. And Maraveni, the race director, had addressed it and certainly improved things on that front, certainly last year. This year, there are some pretty long schleps between stages, which I'm sure you'll hear riders moaning about when it comes to the final week of the race. And that final week really stands out, obviously, for the difficulty of the race in five mountain stages out of the six stages. The other stages are time trial. And, you know, difficult climbs really sprinkled throughout the route, starting on stage four. And very early for a difficult summit finish in the Giro. Usually there's a fairly moderately difficult summit finish somewhere in the first week, but not usually a difficult one like Mount Etna, four stages into the race. And and then we go up through the centre of Italy, through the Apennines, very difficult stage to Bagno di Romagna. That's a bit of a dark horse for a very difficult stage that a lot of people won't have necessarily picked up on at the presentation, but the sort of old training roads, Marco Pantani. There's a very difficult climb that day, the Monte Fumaiolo. And four stages in the mountains, not all in the Dolomites, Lionel, but one day, particularly in the Dolomites, one very difficult day going over the Pordoi, the Falzarigo, I think, and the Valparola, the Valparola and the Gardena. And stage that goes, well, up the Stelvio, most of the Stelvio twice, and the Mortirolo, although the easy side of the Mortirolo. So there's a lot of climbing there, as you would expect with the Giro. But as we always say, Lionel, the riders make the race, don't they?
They certainly do. And you're talking about the transfers there. There's obviously the first big transfer is going to be by boat, isn't it, from Sardinia to Sicily. So it does mean there are three rest days, but it looks like those three rest days are going to be spent travelling in one way or another, not only for the riders, but for us journalists covering it. The Sardinia start and then the Sicily leg as well. It means that it's almost a week before it actually reaches the mainland of Italy.
Yeah, and it's obviously, quite a symbolic start in the sense not only that it's visiting so much of Italy in this 100th edition and 16 of the 20 regions, but also in Sardinia and Sicily, it's the race is visiting and starting in the birthplaces of the two riders who are likely to be the favourites for the race, or certainly the home favourites, Fabio Aru, who's from Sardinia, and Vincenzo Nibali, who's from Sicily, of course.
Well, you mentioned birthplaces. There's another couple of significant stage towns, because the sort of the godfathers of Italian cycling, Fausto Coppi and Gino Bartali, both of their birth towns are on the route as well, I think. Bartali was born in Florence. There's a stage that starts there. And Fausto Coppi was born in Castellania. Is that right? That's a stage to Europa. So a nod to history in the 100th edition as well.
Yeah, there is. And, you know, I mentioned some of the famous climbs that have also been included on the route, the Stelvio, Mortirolo, and the Pordoi. These are all sort of iconic climbs of the Giro. And one thing that there isn't quite as much of this year is the very high climbs. You know, we talked a lot during this year's Giro about what a big factor altitude was, and the race actually set a new record in 2016, or it equaled the record for times over 2,000 metres for a major tour. I think this year it's only going over 2,000 metres about five or six times, as against, I think, 10 or 11 last year. And yeah, that was a factor, as I said, this year. And also the lack of any really extreme climbs. You know, there's certainly an awful lot of climbing. In fact, a couple of the pundits and past winners, like Francesco Moser, said at the presentation yesterday he thought there was too much. Fabio Aru even said he thought there was too much climbing. But we haven't got the sort of uber climbs. There was a lot of criticism for the Giro organisers a few years back for including too many of these ridiculously steep climbs, like the Monte Zoncolan and the hard side of the Mortirolo. There's not a lot of that this year. A lot of fairly longish climbs, actually, sort of 15 to 20 kilometres, 7, 8, 9%, more kind of Tour de France style climbs, and that might have an impact on the kind of rider that decides to take part as well. I mean, you could say this is more a Tour de France style route than usual for the Giro, because it's also got more time trialing than the Tour de France next year. So there are two time trials at the Giro, and one of them is 38 or 39 kilometres long, and then on the last day we've got 28 kilometre time trial to Milan, and that's more than the Tour de France in 2017.
Well, I wonder whether that will tempt Chris Froome. He's was very enthusiastic about the route when it was leaked and then finally announced. A lot of people wondering whether he would attempt the Giro Tour double. We'll obviously have to wait and see on that one. But once again, there is not a lot for the sprinters after really the opening sort of five or six, seven stages, is there? I mean, you wouldn't be surprised if any sprinters who did take the start in Sardinia really only lasted sort of a week or 10 days, because there's absolutely nothing for them in the second half of the race, is there?
No, I mean, you wouldn't be surprised, particularly because that's what happens every year. I mean, it's sort of 12 stages is the standard for the sprinters to stay at the Giro, and that is what will happen again. In fact, I think all of the sprinters pretty much will pull out, apart from perhaps the Italian ones, will pull out some time before the final rest day, probably maybe after Europa on, or even the day before Europa. And but, you know, I think there's a reasonable number of opportunities for them in the first couple of weeks. You know, on Froome, I mean, I heard him give an interview during the Vuelta, actually, which I'm not sure has been broadcast yet, but where he was asked whether he would consider doing the Giro at any point in the near future, and he pretty much dismissed the idea. And the impression that I got from that interview was that he was never going to do the Giro. He's done it in the past, of course. He infamously got kicked out the Giro in 2008, wasn't it, for holding onto a car. Oh, 2010, sorry, yeah. No, 2000, no, it must have been...
It was when he was with Sky, yeah, and the excuse was that he was going to abandon at the top, and he was just, he had, I think, a knee pain, and he wanted to get to the top where he knew a team car would be. A controversy from the dim and distant past. But it would be interesting if, you know, if Froome were to ride, whether... you know, you'd see a big showdown between Froome, Aru and Nibali. That would be something, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would. I mean, I don't think it's any secret that over the past few years, the Giro organisers, shall we say, have tried very, very hard to entice the biggest stars in the sport using various means to the Giro, probably including financial means. And, you know, I don't know how hard they've tried to convince Sky or to convince Chris Froome to come to the Giro, but it would surprise me, frankly, if he was to be at the start in Alghero. And the same goes for quite a number of other, you know, of the big names, the kind of Galacticos of world cycling. Nibali will be there, Aru will be there, and as far as other potential winners are concerned, I think you have to look at Stephen Kruiswijk, who came very close this year, the Lotto Jumbo rider, and perhaps Esteban Chavez may be back, but they've got a real dilemma that they're going to have to solve, Orica Bike Exchange, because, you know, they've got the Yates brothers, who have both shown this year that they can potentially target general classification in major tours, and Chavez himself, and, you know, you have to think about how are they going to progress their careers, and what will they consider what kind of result would they consider to be progress, and if Chavez was to finish second again in the Giro and then miss the Tour de France, he's never ridden the Tour de France, you know, would that constitute sort of stagnation from their point of view? I'm not really sure. I mean, I think if he comes to the Giro, he has to win it, really.
Yeah, he certainly does, doesn't he? It's the next big step up is to actually win a Grand Tour, as opposed to get very close to winning one. Just lastly, Daniel, it's a fitting route for the 100th edition of the Giro. Now that every year they identify a stage as the Queen Stage, usually the one with the most iconic mountains to be climbed. But from a gastronomic point of view, you know me, I'm always thinking of lunch or dinner, or sometimes lunch and dinner at the same time. From a gastronomic point of view, Daniel, which is the stage for the golden knife and fork? That's what I'm most interested in. Where are we eating?
Well, Lionel, I would have to say that the time trial from Foligno to Montefalco, which is in, well, it's both starts and finishes in Umbria, and mainly for the wine, I would pick that, because there's a fantastic, very little known red wine called Sagrantino di Montefalco from there, and goes very well with a kind of thick type of spaghetti that they eat in that region, which is often accompanied by wild boar sausage and black truffle. So that'll be a good
perfect
day, I'm sure. I'm not sure you're going to make the stage that day. And
well, the good thing is it's a time trial day, so there'll be an opportunity for lunch.
Plenty of time. Mm. And if you want to go out on a high note, Lionel, as well, on the penultimate day, we finish at Asiago, with very famous cheese from Asiago, quite sort of creamy, hard cheese, which I'm sure you'll enjoy too.
Lovely. Perfect. Yeah. Well, thanks very much for that, Daniel. We will catch up in a couple of weeks.
Whoever you are, wherever you ride, whatever the reason, Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories, and vibrant clubhouses and communities all over the world.
Thank you for that, Lionel and Daniel. A little overview there of the Giro d'Italia. I must say thank you very much to our sponsor, Rafa, who you heard about there. Very grateful to them for their continued support of the Cycling Podcast. Now, we're still in the Velodrome, Lionel. It's emptying rapidly. The racing has finished. Before the racing finished, I caught up with Cameron Meyer. Interesting story, Cameron Meyer, Australian rider, always been very, very highly rated. I remember burst onto the scene around 2009, 2010. I remember him at the Tour Down Under. Fancied to really go all the way as a bike rider. Was a brilliant track rider, but a lot of people thought he would transfer those talents onto the road. And he did that to some extent. Rode for Orica GreenEdge for a number of years. Swapped to Dimension Data last winter, but midway through the season, announced his retirement, broke the contract, and retired from the sport at a very young age. I think he's still only 27. I'll just check exactly what age he is, but he's a young man. Anyway, he's here at the London 6 Day. This is his comeback. And as he explains, he took a couple of months out and really thought about what he wanted to do. And here he is, Cam Meyer. Cam, bit of a shock to the system, racing again. How are the legs tonight?
Right, yeah, definitely a shock to the system. A bit of combination of everything. I haven't raced in a while this year, and my training's been good, but nothing replicates racing, especially at this level. And also coming from the flight from Australia, it's a bit of a shock for us on night one. So we're hoping to blow a bit of the cobwebs out, and so far it's going all right.
Was it always the intention for you when you stopped sort of mid-season to come back?
Yeah, I had a feeling that the track is where I wanted to do a lot more of. I really enjoyed the World Championships this year. I really got a taste for that real international track racing, which I love. And I had to take a bit of time away just to consider where I wanted to go. And now this is just the start, I think, of a four-year process to try and get to Tokyo.
So was it the road that really just wore you down? Is that what you'd sort of conclude at the end of that?
I can't pinpoint exactly what it was. I mean, it took time away from the bike, I think, just to really consider what I wanted to do in the next few years. And I can't pinpoint it on one thing. I think it's a combination of things. I mean, I've been riding since I was 12 years old, so that's 16 years now. And it's been pretty full on, 8 years as a pro, track, road, a lot of international events. So it took time away to consider what I wanted to do and really get that love back for it. And I think the love is first on the track. That's where it brings me back quicker, I think. And there's going to be road involved. Just to what extent, I don't know at the moment.
So when you stopped, did you have a complete break for a while? How long did that last?
Yeah, I did. I had two months off the bike. I didn't put any time frame on it. It was just let it happen. Just enjoy life. I was a bit, tried to be a normal human being, which we're caught in a bit of a bubble that we're spent time away in a suitcase racing. So I was a bit of a normal person for a while, and it was 2 months that it took to finally get back on the bike. And then once I did, I loved it again, and I've had a real strong focus to try and get ready for this and the track racing to come.
Was there a moment on the bike where you felt, you know, that you that returning is what you wanted to do?
I don't know. I think there was a moment at the World Championships where I really realised that is going to be something in the future that I want to do the track. When I hopped back on the bike after the 2 months off, as soon as I started having a real goal of trying to do well here, the World Cups and the World Championships next year, then, it was easy to get back into training once I set those goals up. So I'm looking forward to the next bit.
There's obviously, it seems to be more of an emphasis on track racing this winter in particular, with, you know, the six-day series being revived and so on. Is that a factor in you wanting to focus on the track? Do you think that it's possible now, in a way that might not have been a couple of years ago, to make a career primarily as a track rider?
I think it'll slowly head that way. How quickly it happens, I don't know, but series like this are really exciting. I think it's really good for track cycling. I mean, you can look at the crowds here, sold out, I think, five of the six nights. The new Revolution series, I think they're trying to change track cycling to be so appealing, and hopefully it'll really branch out worldwide. Hopefully there's a few changes in the Olympic program that brings the Madison back in, and that will really help someone like me. And I think it'll really help, like, the riders that you see here. I mean, you could get Mark Cavendish back in 4 years' time in Tokyo if he's still going there, if there's a Madison. So I think it's doing the right steps, and I'm looking forward to hopefully track cycling getting bigger and bigger.
So for you, you think track cycling will be your number one focus for the rest of your career?
I never say never. I've got goals on the road. I mean, early season, there's a big focus in Australia, the Australian Nationals and Tour Down Under. So there's road ambitions, but if Tokyo's the goal, and then I won't let anything sort of get in the way of getting to whatever that goal is. So there'll be steps along the way to try and achieve that.
What about a team? Have you signed for a team for next year? Forgive me if this has passed me by.
I haven't signed for a team, and I'm going to probably race for the Australian national team over the next sort of 4, 5, 6 months. That's how it's going to be, I think, at the moment, and then I'll just assess it. I just don't want to rush into signing a contract that then locks me down into the same situation that I might not want to be in. So I just want to enjoy doing these sort of things on my own, doing some World Cups, go to the World Championships, ride the Australian Road Championships, Tour Down Unders, Herald Sun Tours, and ride for the Australian team. And if there's a pro team out there that then fits into what I want to do, then we'll see where that takes me.
So that was Cameron Meyer. He's 28, actually, contrary to my earlier claim that he's 27. He's 28 years old, so still a young rider, and clearly focused on the track. also sounded, I thought, very relaxed, very chipper, actually, in that conversation. Last time I interviewed him was at the Giro d'Italia in Ireland in 2014, that was, wasn't it? And he was in a dismal mood there. He was in a terrible, terrible humour in Ireland at the Giro. I'm not sure if that was indicative or representative of his general sort of attitude, feelings towards road cycling, but he certainly seems in a much happier place now, and you know, he wants to pursue his career on the track. What have you made of tonight's racing, Lionel?
Ah, terrific, wasn't it, really? It feels like the end of a kind of some kind of school disco now, doesn't it?
School disco? More like a rock concert, no?
Also a rock concert, yeah. All the seats are empty. The DJ's still playing bafflingly loud music for the audience of almost nobody now here in the track. Great entertainment this evening, good racing. The Derny race at the end there was a much anticipated thrilling close finish there in the Derny racing.
What are you suggesting, Lionel? Your eyebrows shot up as you said that.
This is the thing, isn't it? Everyone says, oh, six-day racing, it's all scripted and fixed. I mean...
Fixed-day racing,
yeah. I mean, you know, that gets exaggerated a lot, I think. It's still very, very hard racing. You know, nobody's pulling any punches. The only, you know, the Derny race, when there's like six or eight riders, all with a Derny rider, probably the closest to a kind of orchestrated race, because... quite dangerous having the Derny and the cyclist, you know, in tandem on the track at the same time, all vying for space. And you know, that's probably the one event that is has a little bit of theatre to it, shall we say. I would say, I'm not breaking the magic circle here, am I? I'm not gonna get cast out from the world of cycling for revealing that. I mean, maybe I'm completely wrong. Maybe I'm completely wrong on that these days. Perhaps now, but certainly in the day, though, you were the races that were sort of organised. If you go to the Ghent Six, for example, there really is an element of pantomime to the Derny races.
Hey, Rob Hatch, you came and sat with us earlier, then you disappeared again, and you're back. You've finished a long shift there in the commentary box.
6 days? I don't know if my voice is going to last, you know. I'm not used to doing this. I'm used to on telly.
Well, it depends what voice you use. I mean, that's your everyday conversation voice.
Oh, that's because I'm saving posh telly voice for the thingy.
People, believe me, this is Rob Hatch, not some northern imposter. It is Rob Hatch.
I'm trying to be.
Rob, have you had a good night at the first night of the London 6 Day?
I've had a really good night. Something completely new for me. I'm working here for the presentation inside the arena. You've been stuck listening to me all night, actually, so you're probably sick of me. That's why I've changed voices more than anything. I've had a really good night. I really enjoy watching the sprinters, actually. The show, and Chris Hoy was enjoying watching them as well. His old mates having a go at each other. But the whole atmosphere, it's a different atmosphere. There's a bit of an off-season feel to it, but I think that's what we need at this time of the year, isn't it?
Well, it is the off-season. And I think we'll wrap things up there, Lionel. I'm going to come back for other nights of the 6 Day. I think you are as well. We'll try and speak to Mark Cavendish one night. So maybe bump into you in the Velodrome. But we'll reconvene next week for the podcast.
Well, next week's podcast is an extended chat with Ned Bolting, isn't it? So everyone can look forward to that. Ned Bolting is actually here in the centre of the Velodrome. He's working here at the London 6 Day. A brief pause from his one-man show, Bikeology, and we talked to him a little bit about that and a lot about other cycling matters in next week's episode.
Well, that's great. Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.